Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Welcome, everyone, to the Sports Medicine Podcast from the Huffines Institute. Thank you so much for joining us today. We have a great program arranged for you today. We are so happy to have Dr. Paul Batista with us in the studio. Dr. Batista is the division chair of the Sports Management Division here at Texas A&M. He actually got his JD from Baylor University. That means that he is an attorney. He's gone through private practice. He was actually a county judge here in Texas as well, and he may be the only guest we ever have on the podcast who has actually qualified and been admitted to practice before the Supreme Court of the United States. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Tim. I appreciate it.
What credentials that you bring? And our listeners are probably wondering why we're interviewing someone like Dr. Batista. Well, you'll find out. Very interesting. But before we go on, we have to remind you that to listen for the question today, if you answer the question correctly that we ask later on, send us an email, and the first one gets a Huffines Institute podcast t-shirt. And they are snazzy looking, aren't they, Justin?
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
So do I get one for being on the program?
You get one for being on the program, yes.
Great.
So, like I said, we're so happy to have Dr. Batista here. We don't normally read the titles of articles that our guests write. Most of our guests have written extensively in their fields of study. But I can't resist with Dr. Batista. Let me read his last three journal publications titles because they're just absolutely great. Do BCS, and that's Bowl College Series.
Bowl Championship Series.
That's football, yeah. Does Bowl Championship Series national championships lead to recruiting violations? Great question. Are female coaches held to a higher standard of athletics compliance? Criticizing the coach, free speech, defamation, or privileged communication? Great titles. And I'm so glad to have you here so you can talk about all these things, right, in 20 minutes.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So let's start with that last one. There's so many people that criticize the coaches, and we heard our coaches here talked about after they lost three games, they went into drive-through mode, so they never went out to restaurants. They just went through the drive-throughs because they didn't want to hear people talk about them. There's a lot of criticism now of sports figures. Is that defamation, or is that justified?
No, typically it's justified. The idea behind defamation is the U.S. Supreme Court has divided people into three categories, and the coaches fall under the public figure category. So it's extremely hard to make a case as a coach for libel when you're a public figure. Can be done, but very hard to do. So basically the coaches just need to suck it up and get tough and go down the road.
That's why they get paid the big bucks, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
That article also talked about, though, when coaches have something to say, and the administrators want to punish them for what they've said. So it wasn't just about libel and slander either.
Sure. So they can speak their mind.
It depends. If it's a public issue, yes, they can speak their mind. If they speak it publicly, there's a Supreme Court case that says, though, if you speak it internally, you can be punished for what you say internally if you don't follow the policy and the rules. So interestingly, you can go in the public and say something that you can't be punished for, but if you say it within your organization and the organization fires you, you have no recourse.
Wow.
So sort of an interesting dichotomy there.
So free speech, really, there's some real gray areas there that not everyone has free speech.
Oh, sure. Free speech is relative. You know, the old 1894 or whatever it was Supreme Court case that said there's a limit on free speech. You don't have the right to run into a crowded theater and holler fire.
That was in 1894?
I believe late 1890s.
Wow. Okay. So it just shows that I'm not a constitutional scholar.
Well, I'm not an exercise physiologist either.
You know, you bring an interesting perspective here. Your research area is sports-related liability issues. Can you tell our audience a little bit more about what those issues kind of revolve around or include?
Well, because we're in the College of Education, obviously I wanted to take a research agenda that related to education.
Mm-hmm.
And as I got into that, I was thinking in my mind things like negligence and players getting injured, risk management, things like that. There were a lot of people doing that. But as I got into it, I started thinking about and actually came upon an interesting article about other issues that created liability other than just somebody getting injured. So, actually, probably to narrow my research focus down more, I really like writing about First Amendment issues, whether it's religion in schools, whether it's free speech or free association, things like that really interest me. So, and particularly religion in schools. There is virtually no one that doesn't have some interest about religious issues in school settings.
Or an opinion.
Or an opinion. Yeah. And there are cases that come up virtually weekly about things like that. So that has become a very interesting and integral part of my research. And I think if you went out among my colleagues and said, describe Batista's research, I think what they would say is, oh, he's the guy that does the religion articles.
Interesting. Even though you're in sports management.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, you also teach contract law, I believe, right? Sports contract law.
That's part of the class, yes.
So I think that's an area that so many of probably our listeners don't know about. You know, you hear about these athletes and their contracts and the negotiations and so forth. What's different about an athlete's contract versus a general contract?
The zeros at the end.
A lot more zeros.
That's exactly right. It's the amount of dollars that's different. And one of my prior lives, I represented some professional athletes. And people asked me how hard it was. And I said, honestly, the contracts to negotiate them were fairly simple to do because they were fairly well standard. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew most of the components of the contract. It was just a matter of what are the dollars? Mm. What zeros are at the end? Mm. So whether you're negotiating a contract to build a house, buy a business, or represent a professional athlete, it's still a contract is a contract, and you have to have all those contractual elements there. And if the parties agree and sign it, it's a contract.
Well, then you'll be a good one to ask the question. So many people talk about the high salaries that the athletes are paid. Is that appropriate, you know, compared to some other valuable occupations? Firefighters and police officers come to mind. What's your take on that? Are these athletes worth the amount of money that they're being paid, the pro athlete?
You know, a good lawyer can argue both sides of the equation. So I would say, does it make sense for our head football coach, Mike Sherman, to make $2 million a year when the president of the institution makes a fourth of that? I don't know what Dr. Bowen's salary is, but I would guess it's $500,000, give or take a little bit. It just seems to me that the head of the university ought to make more than everybody there, just like the head of any organization should be the highest paid person.
Yeah. I think the president of the United States, what, makes a little bit over $400,000 a year?
Yep, something like that.
Yeah.
And so I would say I think there's a lot of dollars involved that probably shouldn't be in a lot of aspects, both amateur and professional. The other side of the coin is, have you ever heard anyone complain about how much money Michael Jackson made, or how much money some entertainer, Garth Brooks or George Strait,
right,
or some TV personality, that they make too much money? And when you get right down to it, sports is nothing more than entertainment. It's just a different type of entertainment.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, there's a part of me that says, you know, it's just ridiculous that a shortstop that hits 225 is making $6 or $8 million a year. But the other side of me says, how many people could play in the major leagues and hit 225?
Right, right. They have a unique skill.
Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I just know those are some of the questions that I've heard. What do you see as the major issues in sports law today?
Oh, Lord, pick up the paper. There's a new one every day. just think about what we've heard about in the last few days, and I always ask my class this the first day of class. Let's talk about the intersection of sport and law, and let's see what you've just heard in the last few days. So Mike Leach's case, the football coach out at Texas Tech who was suing the university for wrongful termination, the appeals court just a couple days ago rendered a case that said he could not do it based on sovereign immunity. You can't sue the government. I have not yet read the opinion. Honestly, I was a little surprised. I didn't think that would be the result of that case, or at least it wouldn't be cut off before he got to trial.
So that was the judgment. They just said you can't, and they said the university was part of the government and you can't sue the government.
That's correct, governmental liability. And I say that, all I know is what I've read in the newspaper. Again, I've not been able to find a copy of the case, and in the near future I'll read the case. I would suspect that case will end up in the Texas Supreme Court. I don't know if they'll accept it, but if I were Leach's lawyer, I would certainly file the application for petition to get the case heard there. So that's an interesting one to me. Mm-hmm. You know, we've heard about Brett Favre and this sexual harassment claim, so that's another one. You can't listen to the sport talk shows that you don't hear about the NFL and the collective bargaining agreement that expires as soon as the Super Bowl's over. And what's going to happen? Is there going to be a lockout? Is there going to be a strike? What's going to happen with that situation? So that's a major issue that's in the forefront today.
And these are all...
I'll tell you another one that really affects A&M is this announcement that ESPN and University of Texas are going to put together a network, and there are just a ton of legal issues as well as NCAA compliance issues that are involved in that. So I'm really looking forward to following that as it comes to fruition and see what happens. And I notice in the paper that Bill Byrne, our A&M athletic director, and Gary Blair, our women's basketball coach, have already commented about how they think it would create an unfair advantage for the University of Texas, as if they didn't already have a bunch of unfair advantages against most universities. But there really are some issues involved there that should concern people in intercollegiate athletics. But still, from a lawyer standpoint, it's a great story, and it's really going to be interesting to follow.
Because I hadn't thought about it, because that would almost be a 24-hour recruiting channel.
Well, sure.
Could be.
Sure.
Yeah.
And what I read today, ESPN's idea is they want to have a lot of the interscholastic, the high school sports on. So let's say that the University of Texas identifies Gary Blair. Use this example, Brittany Griner, the 6'8 post player for the Baylor women team, who's everybody says is the best basketball player in the world right now, or at least most intimidating. So they identify her as a freshman or a sophomore in high school, and they make sure that every one of her games is on television. Mm-hmm. Well, when she goes to choose a school, who is she most likely to be at least initially favorable toward? Not very hard to figure out. It's the person that put her on television all the time.
Right. Interesting. You know, and after talking to you, I started thinking about all the different ways that law and sports do intersect. Is it my perception that it's more so now than it used to be?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah. Has that become because we're more of a legalistic society now than we have been previously? Or
I have no doubt that's the case, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, but still, you go back, and there are cases in the 1800s about spectators getting injured at ballparks. So it's nothing new, but I think we hear a lot more about it. But then society in general is more litigious.
Yeah. So if we have somebody listening, and they say, you know, this sports law thing really sounds very interesting, I'd like to become an attorney that specializes in that. What do they do? Well, assuming they go to law school.
They need to be very lucky, because there are very few positions, and there's really not an area called sport law where you do sport thing. And let me explain what I mean.
Sure.
In collective bargaining, like the NFL is getting ready to go through, it's no different than collective bargaining for the local telephone employees, the union and management, or the railroad employees, or any other employee in labor law. Contracts for football players are no different than contracts for you to buy a house. So the real difference is not the underlying law. The difference is the law as it applies in a sport fact situation. So having said that, most people in the sport law business just sort of happened to be in the right place at the right time, whether representing a team, they were with a law firm and some team hired that firm to do something, or they knew someone, or, as in my instance, just lucky. I had a friend who was playing the NFL. He had an agent that got some of his money, and he called me and said, how do I get my money back? And it just sort of went from there. And, of course, I always had an interest in sport and law, so it really worked out well for me. And there are ways to get in it, but it's really hard to set out and say, I'm going to do sport law and successfully accomplish that.
So it's, yeah. So it's not something you can put on your dartboard and say, that's where I'm going.
I think you can aspire to that.
Right.
But certainly there are some people that have done it successfully, but not very many.
Right. I guess let's change the conversation a bit to talk about a federal regulation that happened many years ago that still we see effects today, and that's Title IX. People in our audience that don't know what Title IX is, maybe for some of our younger audience, they weren't around during that era, so they don't know. Can you briefly describe Title IX, and we'll chat a bit about Title IX?
Sure. Let me set a historical precedent. Okay. Back many years ago when I was in high school, there were no female sports, mm-hmm. none. Not a single one at our high school. There would be a powder puff football game, and there would be one basketball game where it would be a six-person basketball game. And I think it was that three women stayed on one half and three on the other.
Yeah, that's how it was in my high school, yeah.
Okay, so in 1972, Congress passed the law that ultimately became known as Title IX. And really, it had nothing to do with sport. It was basically, it was the Educational Amendments of 1974 that said that anyone that gets federal funds cannot discriminate based on gender. Mm. And the first, most people find this hard to believe, but when Title IX was first passed, the entire act consisted of 32 words.
Is that all?
And basically it says if you get money from the federal government, you can't discriminate based on gender.
Mm.
And so at that point, the Department of Education, their Office of Civil Rights, was put in charge of writing regulations. So they wrote regulations and came up with the test for how do you comply with Title IX. And I won't go into the details of it, but basically you have to have equal opportunity for each gender.
Hmm.
And of course, the discriminated against gender, the female gender, are really the only ones that have recourse under Title IX, at least in the athletic realm, as the courts have construed the law.
Hmm.
So.
Okay.
So now you hear a lot about Title IX because schools have to comply. Hmm. And it basically, you don't look at an individual sport, male, female. You look at the overall program to see if universities comply. And when you drive around A&M campus, all you have to do is look around at some of the venues and see what A&M has done over the past many years to get in compliance with Title IX. So I have two daughters. They're both golfers,
mm.
and if they would have grown up when I grew up, their only opportunity to engage in sport would have been on the side. There wouldn't have been any school sport for them.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know this has come back up recently, you alluded to, because some universities, to become compliant, wind up dropping men's sports, well-established men's sports in many cases. I know throughout the Midwest, wrestling was really big, and wrestling now at the collegiate level is not as big as it used to be because so many universities dropped it. And I think, were there some lawsuits about against the NCAA and some of these universities where men's sports are being dropped and the backers are trying to get that rescinded, basically?
Sure, there have been lawsuits about that, and every one of them, without exception, has been unsuccessful.
Hmm.
Because the courts say the idea behind Title IX is to protect discrimination against females in sport, and you can do that by dropping men's sports who don't have that same protection, or by building up women's sports. So basically what the courts say is, you dropped a men's sport, we're not going to say that was a smart thing to do, but it doesn't matter,
mm.
because what you have to do is bring up the female to equivalency in order to be in compliance with Title IX. So you're right, there have been a lot of programs that have been dropped. And, of course, the historical argument about Title IX is it has to do with football.
Mm.
And that's historically what everything's about. If you didn't take into account football, and by the way, there was an amendment filed in the late 70s or early 80s seeking to exempt football from
Title
IX unsuccessfully. It was called the Javits Amendment. The whole idea of these huge budgets and squads for football outnumbered anything that there was on the female side. So that's sort of the historical tension there between male and female athletes on university campuses. But most universities now have come into compliance by adding female sports.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's going to be interesting to see what happens when budget crunch start hitting, because my understanding is, and I'm certainly not a Title IX expert, but my understanding of the law is if you ever drop a women's sport you are immediately and forever out of compliance with Title IX, at least one aspect of Compliance IX.
Really?
Of Title IX. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens as all of these budget crunches is hit.
Hmm. Yeah, I worked at a university that didn't have a football program, and so they had fairly equal men's and women's athletic programs as far as numbers. And recently they have begun to put the process in to put in a football team. And suddenly the first biggest question they had to answer was, how are they going to stay compliant with Title IX when they bring the football team in, which is brings in 110 athletes. And you're right, there are no women's sports that have that many participants or on the squad. And so it quickly became a question of, do we add more women's sports or do we reduce the number of men's sports that we have? And it was I think it still is a very heated debate. I don't think they've decided yet.
And there are no good answers to that question because right. No matter what happens, you're not going to make everybody and you're really not going to make hardly anybody happy.
Right. Right. Interesting. It's interesting because that is, I think, the minefield that so many of our athletic administrators now walk because they have to deal with that stuff.
Absolutely, on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. So in one of your, to change gears a little bit, in some of your writings, you talk, as you said earlier, you talk about First Amendment rights and freedom of speech. What is your take on recruiting and freedom of speech? Because you have a situation where coaches are told pretty clearly, or people are told pretty clearly, you can't talk to certain people. Does that fall back under that aspect of they're employed by the university, so they have to?
Well, remember, recruiting falls under the NCAA rules and regulations. There are no laws regarding recruiting. So what you're really talking about is recruiting violations within the NCAA rules. So even if you violated the NCAA rules, for the most part, there are a few exceptions. It's not violating the law. It's not a criminal offense. So there's no free speech implications there.
Oh, okay.
Now, there is a statute in Texas, I believe, is the only state in the country that has it, that says if someone violates an NCAA rule that gets a university put on probation, they can sue the violator for doing that.
That sounds like it arose from past transgressions in Texas.
I would say it arose from past transgressions on this campus.
Interesting.
So, in the late 1980s, there was a Texas A&M booster who was improperly paying players to not do work on a HUD housing project. So he was taking federal money, paying players who weren't doing work, and the university got put on probation, and the Texas legislature stepped up and said, we're not going to have this. And the university stepped up and said, we're not going to have this. They disassociated the booster. And now there's a law so that the university could actually go after the booster to get the money that they lost from not being able to be on television and losing scholarships and things like that.
Interesting. So you can speak all you want to whomever you want to, but if you're violating the NCAA rules, you'll have to deal with the consequences of that.
The NCAA is the punisher, not the law.
Not the law. They just seem like it sometimes.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Well, I think we're coming pretty close to the end of our time here, Paul. We give all our guests an opportunity to have a take-home message for the audience.
I think if I could say anything, I would say try to resolve your differences before you go hire a lawyer.
Hmm.
Because even if you win, you lose, because it costs you a lot of money, it costs you a lot emotionally, which affects every aspect of your life. So I would say to you, try to avoid problems and try to solve them before they get out of hand.
Interesting. Thank you. Good message. I think we all need to remember that.
Thanks.
Yeah. And Paul, thank you so much for being on.
Glad to do it.
Enjoyed,
it's been fun.
Yeah, enjoyed having you here. And before we go to the closing credits, we've got to turn over here to Justin, our producer, who has our T-shirt question.
That's right. So looking at his research, what is Dr. Batista's area of interest with regards to sports law?
So, be the first one to respond with the correct answer to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. Be the first to respond to that email address with the correct answer, and you'll get one of our nifty, one-of-a-kind t-shirts, podcast t-shirts, that you can wear proudly. Once again, Paul, thank you so much for being here.
Glad to do it. Enjoyed it.
Thank all of you for tuning in this week and listening, and we hope you have a great day and have a healthy and active week.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Justin Dobson and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.